Hey, Chicago. What do you say? Cubs gonna win today.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time for the baseball podcast with national baseball writer David Brown.
Hi, Andy.
Dave, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm excited about... Are people who see this going to notice a difference?
They are not.
Okay, then never mind.
At some point they will, but right now it's just you and me. We have a new... We have a new studio. For lack of a better word, we're recording this. So
virtual studio.
If it sounds so much better, that's why. And if it doesn't, that's why. It has nothing to do with us.
Right.
So as on this podcast, we talk about the Cubs, but we also I take advantage of your big baseball brain, and we talk about other things going on in baseball. And one of the things I want to talk about today is the Athletics announced that they have a new lease on life and for stadium in Sacramento, where they're going to share the AAA ballpark with the Giants' AAA affiliate, the Sacramento River Cats. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. The guy, I always want to call him Vivek Ramaswamy, but that's a different guy. The guy who owns the Kings owns that stadium. And he's buddies with John Fisher, the owner of the A's. So they hammered out this deal pretty quickly to move there. They're going to play there next year and the year after and the year after. And if their ballpark in Vegas is never built, the year after that. So they could be spending 4 years in beautiful Sacramento in a 10,000-seat minor league ballpark that they announced today. If they mow the grass in the berm, 14,000 people can get crammed into that place.
Depending on the size of your booty.
Yes. Now, I don't know how much of this you know, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I know that when the original idea that the A's were going to, their temporary home, their AAA team, ironically, is in Vegas, and they were going to go there, and the Players Association said, well, yeah, but that park is not a major league caliber park, and here is a list of things you have to do to make it so that we'll allow big league games to be played in there. Now, my assumption is that the same list applies to Sacramento.
Right.
So they're going to have to do some things to the park. A former big leaguer posted on Twitter that who I guess had played in that park at Sacramento, and I don't know, I didn't recognize his name, said that there are things like all major league parks have like a family room.
Yeah.
They don't have that. They only have one place to hit, only one batting cage for both teams. And you're not supposed to do that. And there's other stuff.
This was Trevor Hillenberger who was a side-arming right-hander for the Twins, amongst others.
Oh, good. At least you knew who that. Glad you knew who that was.
Yeah.
So what do you know about what you might have to do to a minor league ballpark to make it big league ready?
Well, there's two different tears about this, because the Blue Jays, for example, played in Buffalo when we had the pandemic and you couldn't get into Canada, basically, or leave. So, you know, that was kind of an emergency situation. And Buffalo was also, if you know anything about the history of that stadium, it was built with possibly getting MLB teams in mind at one point. So it's kind of like a junior version of that. And I think Sacramento might be a little bit like that. I'm not sure what they have in Vegas exactly, but there are, you know, official and unofficial amenities like Trevor Hildenberger was talking about that kind of make a, and it's, I think it's entirely negotiable, but there's a certain amount of things that the players are going to want, and there's going to be a certain amount of things that they'd like to have, but maybe couldn't have. I still think the union could go to block this. I mean, we're not, you know, in an official pandemic anymore. It's not, you know, those emergency stipulations don't apply. So I think if it's bad enough, and I've never been to I don't think I've ever been to Sacramento. It's one of the bigger cities that I've never visited, so I haven't seen a game there. If the players' union wanted to, they could raise a stink about this, and it would be fitting because, you know, everywhere the A's turn, it's kind of been a half-assed operation on their behalf anyway, but they've been kind of stopped. It's funny, too, that they'd have to share this stadium with the Giants, who through the years have blocked numerous places in the Bay Area where the A's wanted to go to build a ballpark. But the Giants, because they got there first in 1958, like had the rights to places like San Jose, and I don't know if they had Fremont too, but at least one other place where the Giants said, no, A's, you can't move 25 miles here. We own that. So it's fun that the Giants don't have any territorial rights in Sacramento, but they're still using the stadium. So it's just kind of funny that there the Giants are again, kind of being the A's foil.
All hell has broken loose here. Hey, guys.
We have some A's fans here. Yep. They don't want the team to leave.
One of the issues that I don't think has been worked out yet is one of the reasons they didn't go to Vegas, one thing that probably should have been the primary reason was it's a desert and it's an open-air stadium. But the real reason that they didn't want to was their deal with NBC Sports California would be voided if they left the Bay Area, and they get $58 million a year from that, which it's a lot of money for them since they try to run that club, not just on the cheap, on the destitute, basically. But also it's a terrible deal now for NBC Sports California because you're paying $58 million to air the games of a completely non-competitive team.
Yes.
I can't imagine ad sales are great. And they could get out of it. And they dispute whether or not Sacramento counts as their like territory. So chances are I would hope, although they're the A's, they've come to some kind of handshake agreement with NBC Sports California about maybe a slightly diminished rights fee so they can still get some money, get some TV money. But that's a big issue as to why they tried to stay in Northern California until they can move to Vegas, and then they think they're going to cash in with a big TV deal, which 4 years from now, nobody's going to have a big TV deal, but you know, why not be behind the eight ball the entire time if you're the A's?
Well, Sacramento is a bigger city than Oakland, although that's just like in city limits area. Yeah. If you count areas outside Oakland, you know, it's much bigger.
Yeah.
In Sacramento. So there's that's about 75 miles away, I think, Sacramento. So it's not something that you could fans could do. And it's not, you know, it's like going to it's Milwaukee. It's like the difference between Milwaukee and Chicago. Yeah. They're two different places. It's not the same place.
Yeah, I think the Bay Area is either the fourth or fifth biggest media market in the country.
Yeah.
And Sacramento is not in that media market.
No.
And so it's far smaller. It'd be like the Cubs moving to Rockford.
Would you like that?
Well, I guess it does apply to the Cubs. It'd be the White Sox moving to Rockford and telling NBC Sports Chicago. It's basically the same thing. You're just going to keep cutting us the same size checks. To me, it's hilarious that they have to share this with any AAA team, much less the Giants. So there's basically going to be something happening in that stadium every day all summer between the AAA schedule and the big league schedule. And that presents a whole bunch of problems. I would guess they're going to have to build clubhouses, two new ones, they build a little one and put the AAA teams in it, or build a big one and put the big league teams in it. Because otherwise, it's poor clubbies emptying and filling a clubhouse every 7 days. But there's also the stuff about when you're an injured A, and you stay behind and you need to work out, you've got, 50 minor leaguers running around your stadium using all the stuff you thought you were going to use while you were rehabbing. They also are apparently not going to be referred to as the Sacramento A's. So in limbo, they're just going to be the Athletics, like the opposite of the Washington football team.
Mm.
Instead of a city without a nickname, they're a nickname without a city. It's very weird.
And sort of on this note, kind of, the identity issues, the owner, John Fisher,
mm-hmm.
right? At a press conference today, in which he took no questions, he called the new ballpark, it would be the most intimate in the league. And there's a word for you. And he was excited to see Aaron Judge hitting home runs in it.
Good.
Aaron Judge is not on the A's.
No.
Although he is from the Bay Area, although Sacramento is not.
No.
So I don't know if he's like waiting for Judge. He's like, oh, Judge is going to love this comment. When he's a free agent again at age 41 or whatever. So
that's right.
I thought that was bizarre as well. The whole thing.
Got to make the A's pitchers feel good.
Yeah, right.
The owner can't wait to see us giving up huge bombs to one of the Yankees. It's the thing he's looking most forward to with the new stadium. Here in beautiful Rockford, a few years ago, God, I don't know how long it's been now, 15 years ago maybe, they built a new minor league stadium, and they were building it as quickly as possible, and they weren't going to have the clubhouses ready for the start of the season. I don't know if they were going to make the guys like dress on a bus and then go out, but fortunately for them, the Packers were in the middle of renovating Lambeau, and the Packers for training camp had bought these two huge temporary, I don't even know what you'd call them, like big, huge box containers, basically, that they built locker rooms in. And they were apparently really nice. And they didn't need them anymore. And the then Rockford Riverhawks, who are now the Rivets, bought them. And the idea was they would be their temporary clubhouses. And so they had, the Packers had two, so they took them and they put one on one side of the stadium and one on the other, and they had their clubhouses. Still using them. And the only complaints I've ever heard from any of the players was there are a bunch of feral cats who live under the temporary clubhouses and occasionally attack the players.
Attack?
Yes. Come jumping out from under it and bite them and run off. And they're like, God, do we need rabies shots now? Get attacked by the feral cats at the Rivet Stadium. So what I think will probably happen is I think the A's will probably buy those from the Rivets.
Right.
They won't get new ones. Like, oh, that's a good idea. Let's go find some new ones. They'll be like, how old are those? They're only 15 years old. They're falling apart at the bottom. That's fine. We'll patch the holes and let the cats can come with.
Can they be transported by like Black Hawk helicopter?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know those. You might be able to just one F-150 might be able to tow both of them the way from Rockford to Sacramento. I would think. Right. It'd only take a month or two. It'd be no problem.
Maybe that or something like pods, you know, on the lawn, on the front lawn will be.
That's probably exactly what it'll be. It'll just be
flip
that thing down and, hey, we got four of them. We got one for the home pitchers, one for the home hitters, and we got one, actually three. We just bought one for the visitors. They can share it. Just pull that door down and climb in and hang your crap on a hook. It'll be fine.
And when the Giants AAA team is home, maybe the rehabbing A's players can just go to Lifetime Fitness.
Yeah.
Work out there.
Yep. At off peak hours. Do they get a discount if they don't, if they use it like after midnight and before 6 a.m.?
Yeah. They'll hear about it if they don't.
Yeah. Bring your own towel. We're not paying for towels. One thing I wonder if they'll install is the A's players are used to the sewage fountains in the dugouts. They have to put those in?
Yeah, I don't know what the water situation is. Is it dire in Sacramento like it might be in Southern California? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
What kind of what they get as far as how clean it is.
Or the capacity, the 10,000, that could be 14. I mean, ironically, they will draw better in Sacramento than they do in Oakland simply because of the novelty of, hey, we have a big league. We're big league games, even if we don't have a big league caliber team, we have
at least for the first couple of years. I don't know about all four or five or whatever it's going to be.
But they, I don't know if you saw, somebody got a hold of some very friendly instructions handed out to game day workers in Oakland.
Yeah.
For the first homestand. And basically it was all really positive stuff. It's, you know, well, we're expecting 3,500 fans per game. If we don't get more than that, then this entrance will be closed. We don't need it, blah, blah, blah. And the only thing on it was, if anybody has anything that says rooted in Oakland in it, you must confiscate it from them. And just, and there was something else. There were two things that you couldn't have in the park. And I forgot to look. They had a pretty decent crowd for opening day. Their problem was most of those people never went in the park.
Right.
They do these parking lot boycotts where they buy the cheapest tickets you can get to the game to access the parking lot, and then they just tailgate and they don't go in. They have a great time, but they don't go in the stadium because they don't want to spend any money in the stadium to help fund this effort. And I mean, I can't imagine now what the crowds are going to look like.
I mean, can you? Hundreds, dozens, at some point.
Yeah.
A bad team. There's a boycott going on. There, you know, everybody knows they're leaving. It's. I hope. I don't wish anything good for John Fisher, but I hope the Las Vegas thing falls through sooner rather than later, and they can pivot to something else. Yeah. So, I don't know.
I guess the thing I was thinking about was, if, say, the Vegas thing falls through and Rob Manfred finally, you know, he's outgoing. He's not outgoing. He's introverted, but he's an outgoing commissioner.
Lame duck.
Finally sacks it up and gets some of the other owners to force Fisher to sell that team. The stadium alternative in Oakland that has always made the most sense is to tear down the Coliseum and build a new stadium there.
Right.
The stadium's all screwed up because of the Raiders and other things. And the biggest hurdle to that is, if you tear down your stadium, where do you play? Well, you're going to be in Sacramento for the next 4 years. You have plenty of time to tear the stadium down, build a new one, and move back. And then the whole thing about being in Sacramento completely, the whole culture behind that changes. All of a sudden it becomes a positive.
It becomes a plus.
Yeah. It's like, well, we're only temporarily there because we're going to build a state-of-the-art stadium and go back to Oakland. And you actually probably would get big crowds because you would get Oakland fans who would go, because they'd be excited about the team staying. But I don't think anybody thinks that's actually going to happen. But now would be the time to do it, because you have your alternative in place that you would have needed.
It would be a nice moment in Manfred's legacy, which is, you know, kind of spotty. Maybe I'm being nice about that. And it would be a better psychological, mental deal than having, you know, even getting through this season. It's going to be brutal being in Sacramento for years. It's just, you know, it's not a matter of months like Buffalo with the Blue Jays or their spring training site was, or even one season. It's going to be a huge drag.
Yeah. Well, and even if the Vegas thing works, most of the players who are going to play in Sacramento aren't going to Vegas.
Right.
You know, they have very few, if any, players who are in their long-term plan. Some of the prospects, I guess, they could.
Yeah, but at this rate, they, you know, they've been in the habit of trading those guys anyway by the time that happens. So.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see how many guys who play on opening day next year in Sacramento are still in the organization if they really do move to Vegas and play there.
Especially if it takes that extra year.
Well, speaking of the Bay Area, there's another connection to this. On Monday, this will affect the entire, I think the whole world, at least our hemisphere. There's an astronomical, is that the right word? Astronomical event.
An eclipse?
That happens once every few years where Giants designated hitter Jorge Soler passes between the Earth and the Sun and blots out the Sun. They can even call it a solar eclipse.
Oh, man.
No?
Yeah, you could call it that.
He's big enough.
He's a big man.
He could blot out the sun. That's what I assumed when I saw it.
You think he would find that funny? He might.
Big George? Sure.
Yeah.
sure he'd find it hilarious.
Seems affable enough.
One of the Cub things I wanted to talk about was the Cubs find themselves in an interesting dilemma where they are trying to turn Christopher Morel into a third baseman. And he is off to a incredibly good start at the plate and an incredibly bad one in the field. To the point where at the plate, he doesn't – the idea that he might be good, that is completely – Cub fans aren't even worried about that anymore.
Yeah.
It's, can he become a superstar?
Yeah.
Because he's not just not striking out. He doesn't swing and miss. When he decides he's going to swing at the pitch, he hits it hard somewhere, fair or foul. He's just turned into a really good hitter. And he's a great athlete. I shouldn't say that. He has great athleticism. I think if you can't put it to use, I don't know if you can call it a great athlete. But he's playing third base. He's made four starts there. He's finished one game. And he's made four errors. And the big issue with taking him out in the seventh inning, which they've done three times to put the great Nick Madrigal in to play defense, is you then finish the game with Nick Madrigal in your cleanup spot.
Right.
And like last night, the Cubs are up 8-2 when they take Morel out. And you're like, geez, if he's ever going to finish a game, it's the 8-2 game.
You've got some cushion.
And he'd already made an error, which I think is why they took him out. And then Nico Horner, Gold Glover Nico Horner, underhanded a ball over the first baseman into the dugout. It allowed a couple of runs to score. And the next thing you know, it's 8-8. And the Cubs are rallying in the bottom of the eighth to try to take the lead. And looming in the on-deck circle is Nick Madrigal. with runners on, they got a hit, and then Cody Bellinger drove in another run. I think that's how that worked. Maybe not. But anyway, Nick didn't. They had the lead by the time Nick had to come up with his career 323 slugging as a Cub. So the question I have for you is, there's more I want to preface it with. There's this feeling in Chicago where Dan Bernstein is having an aneurysm every day on the score. About how you have to end this. Morel has to go back to be your DH because this division might be decided by one game. And if he throws a game away in April, that could be the one that costs you, which I just think is just ridiculous. But, how long do you think you can do on-the-job training for a player in the big leagues before you're like, I don't know if this is going to... Before you can make a decision as to whether it's going to work or not... And balance that, maybe it's just part of the equation, with do you really expect a guy to be all of a sudden be really good at a defensive position when we haven't stuck him at one? Like it feels like the Cubs...
This is a bed that the Cubs have kind of made for themselves. Yeah. So then what do you do after that? I think you can't go back in time and give him more time at third base, you know, which would have been nice.
Yeah. Well, he should have played it last year.
He should have done. Yes, and that's not a new complaint. People were saying that as it was happening.
Yep.
I'm just thinking. I think Council maybe has to get. You know, can you switch him to left field late in the game? Is that no? Because Ian Happ is a two-time platinum blonde winner.
Oh, he had quite a night last night. He missed. I don't know. Something wrong with his eyes, or maybe the cold weather didn't work. There was a pop up to left field that he camped under. He was going to catch it. It was. Yeah. This was not him being funny. The marquee camera zooms in, and all of a sudden, it has to take a hard left because Morel is actually catching the ball down the line. Cap misjudged it by 40 feet, and then later in the game, a ball that he either thought was a home run and got blown back, or he just couldn't see. Landed at the base of the wall, and he had to run out there and pick it up and throw it.
In all of the Wrigley renovations, did they ever, you know how it was like dark in the corners? Is it still dark?
Well, they have fancy new lights.
Okay. Yeah,
the fancy new lights. Of all lights. They're supposedly, they fixed all that stuff. Yeah.
All right. Anyway, I'm looking out for the guy. I'm trying to give him excuses.
Your thinking is exactly what I was doing today, which was, all right, if you need to get him off third late in the game, where are you going to put him? Because you need to keep his – right now, him and Saya are your two best hitters, and you don't want to take either one of them out at the end of a game where could you put him? And, you know, he's ironically, he's probably the only position he's really ever looked competent at is second base. And you're not going to take Nico Horner, even though he did, you know, he made one of his rare errors last night. You're not taking Nico out in a close game to put Morel at second.
I haven't watched all of his time in the infield. Has his issue been more throwing or fielding?
Well, here's the nice thing about it. It's four errors. Two are throwing, and two are he just missed line drives. I'll just say what I would do if I were the Cubs. I would stop taking him out and just let him play. I don't but I'm of the opinion, because I have eyes, that the Nick Madrigal defensive upgrade is a myth.
There isn't one.
No.
Yes, correct. When did he turn into Buddy Bell?
Right. Last night, he apparently, he on a smashed on the line, when he came in for defense, it went right through him. Apparently, it broke his glove, a la Jake Cronenworth.
No kidding.
And as one guy tweeted at me, he's like, that's what happens when you try to use one of those little plastic kitty gloves through an entire season. They're just not going to last. To me, the difference is Morel will make an error of commission.
Right.
Madrigal makes them of omission. Balls he either can't get to or he can get to, but he can't make a throw from where he catches the ball. So I don't feel like it really helps to switch. You just downgrade your offense under the illusion that, oh, this guy's such a good defensive third baseman. There's no proof to that.
I feel like there's two things working here. One, they are working themselves into a tizzy over Morel's defense. Two, with Madrigal, there's like this thing that we have to squeeze some value out of him. We can't give up on him. We've got to do something with him to make the whole trade worth it. And he's not a significant defensive upgrade at third base. That doesn't really make any sense. I think there's still... They're holding on to the old ghost or whatever the saying is that he has some value. So we have to get rid of one of those things at least. And I think with Morel, you know, at least he brings something on the offensive side that, excuse me, I think you stick with him. I agree with you. Stick with him in the field at least for a while. It's only the first week.
Yeah.
It's only the first week.
He is only played, by my advanced math, I think he's played 30 innings at third base so far. So
Right. Clearly
it's time to give up on it. Oh, it's been we gave him 30 innings, and he made four errors. He's
how long 30 innings
terrible.
Are, buddy?
Yeah, I mean, the whole Madrigal thing, I think if he hadn't been the fourth overall pick in the draft, he's not in the big leagues right now.
Right.
I think it was the Sox were smart enough to go, this is not happening. And then the Cubs are like, well, we traded a good player for him, and we can't give up on this. The other thing I wonder, they have a decision to make sometime next week. Patrick Wisdom is on the disabled list, and he's supposed to come off. And somebody's got to go to Iowa, either Nick Madrigal or Miles Mastroboni. I would guess they're going to send Mastroboni down, which I think is stupid. Maybe an average big league player, probably a little bit below, but I think he's a far more useful player than Madrigal is. He can play second, third, and short. He could stand out in the outfield and, you know, possibly catch a fly ball. He's a switch hitter. He's a much better, but you can't be a worse base runner than Nick Madrigal. But when Wisdom comes back, does he become the late inning replacement if you just keep doing that, where at least you have a power threat in the cleanup spot? The only problem is he's just not as good a hitter. He's nowhere near as good a hitter as Christopher Morel. You're hurting your chances to keep scoring by taking him out of games. 2 years ago, Wisdom was a very good defensive third baseman. Last year, he wasn't. And it turns out it was because he had a bad back. Well, he was on the injured list this year so far because he's got a bad back. So he might not be a defensive upgrade just because he can't bend over, which I think is an important part of fielding a ground ball.
Same injury?
I don't know if it's chronic or if it's, you know, hey, congratulations, you screwed up a different part of your back this time.
Right.
So I don't know.
Yeah, in theory, though, that is a little more palatable to if his defense is where it was a couple years ago. I mean, at least that makes some sense. Madrigal only makes sense because he's got some cachet as that trade piece.
Yeah, but I took issue with the idea that because I just think it's insane. Well, he might cost you a game in April, and then you're going to miss the playoffs, and that's why. How many games are you going to end up losing because his bat's not there at the end, and all of a sudden you need to score again, and you don't have him there? I mean, if the best thing for the Cubs would be for him to become a competent third baseman defensively.
So they need to have some patience.
Right, so you just finally have to leave him there. And I felt like Council had it, but this taking him out at the end of every game thing is just creates a new dilemma. It's like, give him a couple of months and, you know, let him try to settle in. But yeah, it's so far it's been fun, the variety of errors. You know, the one of them, he's got too much time to throw and he sails it. Another time he's got a rush and he doesn't. He's made some nice plays. You know, he's a really athletic player.
Yeah.
And they'll have another issue coming up. It would be a good issue for the Cubs to have is if the promised prodigal son, P. Crow Armstrong, is ever ready to come up. The plan clearly then is he goes to center most days. Cody goes to first. Michael Bush becomes your designated hitter. Well, it doesn't work if Morrell is now your designated hitter because you've given up on him playing. And people are like, well, Bush could play third. He played it for the Dodgers. Yeah, he played it so well that they didn't ever want him to play there again.
Yeah.
I feel like you'd have the exact same thing going on with him, although maybe that would be – maybe they would say, that, okay, that's better. You know, Michael Bush isn't around at the end of the game instead of Christopher Morrell. To me, it's all – at this point, it's all stupid. It's like, just play guys and see what happens.
I always kind of thought that Bush was a bit of an odd fit for that reason because they had Horner at second and then they had – Armstrong in the outfield, which means Bellinger would go to first. So, although they, I guess I was thinking when they made the trade, they didn't have Bellinger yet, but yeah. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. And I think they're of the opinion that they won't have him next year, that Cody's only here for 1 year. And
yeah.
This will all sort itself out. Then there's the other option, which is farther on down the road, but it's Matt Shaw, last year's number one pick, who impressed everyone in the spring, and they sent him to Tennessee. He's going to start in Double A, but there's very little difference between playing at Double A and playing at Triple A these days.
Yeah.
He's also not a third baseman. They gave him the same crash course that they gave Morrell, but it seems to have taken better. Like he looked
well. He's a shortstop, right? Naturally.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a much easier. In fact, to him, he's going to an easier spot to play. Probably.
Yeah.
So there's that, but it's interesting. Our old friend Joe Madden has been making the rounds, and I think I don't know what he's promoting. The weird thing where he's like becoming a corporate coach for whatever Sage is. You've seen those awful commercials where Joe is fixing their culture.
I've seen or heard one. I saw it, and I thought it was a joke. I thought it was,
yeah.
I'm not sure. I thought he was like, not a joke, but I thought he was pitching the company, not being a coach in the company. I thought it was just he's doing a commercial for them.
Yeah. But anyway, so he's been going on more. It's not like it's hard to get Joe to come on a podcast.
No.
He likes to talk. And he was on the Starkville podcast with Jason Stark and Doug Glanville. And he's made this point other places, which I thought was very good. But they asked him, obviously, about Shohei. He managed Shohei for 3 years. And if he was surprised, and he said he was stunned by what happened, not just because he knows Shohei, but because he knows Ipe. And thought, you know, that didn't seem like it was something. And he had an interesting person that he pinned some of the blame on. And that was the whole issue. Basically what he was asked was, from what you know, would it be entirely like likely that Ipe would have access to Shohei's finances? And Joe said, from what I know, yes. Like, he's not just the translator. He might be Shohei's, probably not anymore, but he was Shohei's best friend. He was basically like his, like a business liaison.
Yeah.
Almost.
Like a buddy and, or a brother you grew up with.
Yeah.
That you trusted, that you brought with you when you were successful.
Yeah.
We see that a lot in other sports too.
Joe likened it to like turning a busy person, like a baseball player or manager, turning his finances over to a spouse. Basically,
yeah.
Saying, I don't have time for this. I trust you. You take care of all this, pay all the bills, do all the other stuff. But he's made an interesting point, which was if that's true, he was paying millions of dollars to a bookie, why wouldn't Shohei's agency, which is Nesbolelo, wouldn't they know? Like, they're also part of helping Shohei pay his bills and do some of that other stuff. How would it have caught everybody by surprise that this happened?
One of the parts of this that has not made any sense, and it goes back to when the crisis first materialized. They apparently were, Bilalo was orchestrating the response, the first response, where Shohei was quoted as saying, yeah, I paid the debts off, and oh, no, we didn't mean that. They came back and walked that back. But they were still using ePay as part of that messaging.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to kind of answer the question, wouldn't they have known? I don't know if they would have known, but it seems like they're a bunch of doofuses. And if they didn't know, it was, you know, out of ignorance that, you know, that they should have known, and or incompetence that they would kind of continue to let this happen, especially if they're going to use ePay on the initial messaging once this thing blew up. That part, to me, made the least sense of all. It's like, you know, this guy has just admitted to gambling away the money. I guess they hadn't determined yet that he had stolen. But they let it happen. It's like, you know, the fox eating the hen house and then using the fox for PR later. It was bizarre.
Yeah, and that's been my take on it from since the very first when they walked back that initial message. Gambling in California is sports gambling in California is illegal. It's not one of the states where it's legalized. So basically, they're like, so the story comes out, ePay got in way over his head, and then Shohei paid it off, and then they realized, that's bad.
Yes,
baseball wouldn't like if Shohei paying off gambling debts for somebody else. And then they're like, well, ePay already committed a crime by doing the gambling. Might as well just pin all of it on him. So he stole it. Shohei had no idea that he took the money. You know, to me, it's always been far more realistic to think that Shohei thought he was helping his friend and then realized, this is going to get me in trouble. I didn't do anything. I was just trying to help him. So we're going to have to just pin it all on ePay. And then there's a lot of I'm absorbing a lot of Japanese culture these days.
Oh, really?
Yes. Not only because there's a really good hibachi restaurant just up the road, Jam Cane upon a Rockford. If they want to give me free food, I'll happily go there.
Sure.
But also, I'm playing a Ghost of Tsushima on PlayStation 5, which, you know, I'm basically fighting a Japanese civil war. Well, I'm one lonely samurai avenging lots of deaths. I'm also watching Shogun on Hulu.
You're Shogun basically 10th in line for the throne. Is there still a throne?
If like King Ralph, if they take a big picture of all the emperor's relatives and it catches fire and they all die, I get to be the emperor.
Right.
They still have an emperor in Japan? I don't even know how that works.
Yes.
So one of the things that makes the show so good, a decision they made, which they didn't make in the original Richard Chamberlain one in the 80s.
You're not doing spoilers, are you? I haven't seen this.
No, I'm not going to spoil anything.
Okay.
Is in that one, basically everybody spoke English. You're just supposed to be like, okay, fine, you know, they're in Japan. Just imagine in your head that they're speaking Japanese, but we're not going to subtitle. People won't read subtitles. Nobody will watch the show.
They're not wrong.
With this one, they lean completely into the subtitles. They don't care. And so everybody in the show either speaks Portuguese or Japanese. And so if they speak Portuguese, we see it in English. But if they speak Japanese, it's subtitled. The creators actually talked about an ironic, like the subtitles are very well done, not only in like, they don't, sometimes subtitles give away too much, like they show too much of the sentence, like you see too much of it at one time,
and you're
like, oh, this is going to give this away. They're very good about that. The other thing they did, though, was apparently they really liked the way Star Wars does subtitles as far as the font that they use and where they place it on the screen. They place it slightly higher so that you can read it and and see the face easier. So the acting like comes through, which sounds stupid, but it actually it works.
Interesting.
And they shot, because they knew they were going to subtitle it, they framed the shots for the subtitles. So the subtitles don't cover important stuff in any of the shots. It's really good. Well, this is a long way to get to this. So one of the main characters in it is, she is translating for the Englishman who has washed up on their shore. And because they show the Japanese in subtitles and we hear him in English, you get a really good feel for how she translates him and how she is very selective sometimes about, because he says all kinds of, you know, he's pissed. He wants his ship back and he wants to do all this stuff. And she knows it's going to piss off. So she's like, and either there's one where her husband and him are actually like, they're having an argument through her. And she's toning down what both of them are. They can tell how mad they are at each other. They know, they have a pretty good idea that he didn't really, he said a lot worse than that. But it, in an ironic way, it made me think of Ipe, because here's a guy who, in a completely twisted thing, could take Shohei's answers and just frame them however he wanted the answer to come out, and could take the question and frame it to Shohei however he wanted to cover his ass.
Right.
And it was crazy. You made a perfect point. It was crazy to me that they let him translate that huge moment after he had admitted to the gambling.
Right.
Like, he got to run that press availability basically the way he wanted. Now, clearly, there are people who go back and look who speak Japanese and English and be like, okay, this was bullshit. He didn't explain this right to Shohei. But he right. got to, in real time, he got to do it. It was nuts. Another thing I forgot to mention during the A's thing was you talked about how John Fisher had a press conference with no press.
Yeah.
The reason was they literally they announced the move, and then they set up the press conference knowing they didn't give the San Francisco media enough time to physically get, or the Oakland San Francisco media to physically get to the press conference. Nice job.
An in real life version of turning the replies off on Twitter. Yeah.
Because the one guy there from the Sacramento Bee, I don't think was going to be able to, you know, carry the, you know, ask all the questions that were going to get asked from the from the A's media. But yeah, so Joe was, I felt like he raised a really good question, which was, I think what it did, whether Joe meant to or not, it to me, it casts even more doubt on the story we've gotten so far.
Yeah.
Because there's another safeguard in place that would have had to have been Ipe, but it had to be some kind of mastermind by now. You'd think a guy that this smart would be able to be more successful with his bets. You know, he can't, keeps taking the over on the Lakers, but has enough wherewithal to steal money from Shohei and hide it from the high-powered agents.
I want to see his slips like Pete Rose. Is John Dowd still alive?
I think he is.
Yeah.
Dude, somebody this week told a story about how they have an autographed copy, original copy of the Dowd Report. I can't think of who it was, but the reason they got it, I love this, was he's the guy who told John Dowd that in MVP baseball, whatever year, that they named, that Barry Bonds wasn't in it, but so they named him John Dowd. And John had his, like, grandson show him in the game. And he liked it so much that he autographed a bound copy of the official Dowd Report and sent it to the sports writer as a thank you. And the guy still has it, like, on a shelf behind him on Zoom calls.
That's a dream. That's, like, a dream I didn't even know I had. That it would have been to, like, to tell John Dowd about that he's in the video game as Barry Bonds. Yeah. The closest thing I ever got was when I told Larry Durker that Harry the Hat Walker had died. So that's the best I could do on that front.
Was Larry was he upset or happy?
He was shocked.
Harry was like,
"Whoa!" It was his manager when he played with the Astros in the '60s and '70s, and then sad.
Yeah, the hat came up, and I remember this crap. because he got. Somebody, one of the Cub, we were doing the great left fielders and terrible left fielders of Cub history, and one of them had been acquired in a trade that Harry the Hat Walker was involved in. It detoured us into nicknames used to be so much dumber but better back right. in the days.
Right.
Now all they do is they got these I blame it on Mike Quadi. It's Mike Quadi's fault. The nicknames suck now. Quadi gave everybody a nickname. Right. But he did the hockey thing where he just added a Y to everybody's name.
I was
going
to say, let's make sure to blame hockey too.
Yes. Or they just take your first initial and then the first three letters of your last name. And those aren't nicknames. Right. Those are abbreviations. It doesn't count. We got to get back to cool nicknames again. Ironically, the guy who's trying to bring nicknames back is Bears head coach Matt Eberflus, who gives cartoonish nicknames to everybody on the team. And there's a great video of him before the final home game going around where everybody's stretching, and he refers to everybody by their nickname.
And some of them are really good. That might actually make me like him.
Yeah. Oh, he's a whole makeover. He's got the new haircut and the beard. He looks a million times
better. I've seen.
He's handed out nicknames. His defense was the number one defense in the NFL the last 5 weeks of the season last year. I mean,
Got to see this video. I got to see Shogun. So.
Yeah, you got a lot of homework.
I remember watching the Richard Chamberlain version of Shogun, and I fell asleep. I was only 8.
Yeah, I do too. We were kids. Like, and I have a feeling there's no way it was this cool. Like, the battles in this are really good. There's an earthquake. There's incredible earth. I don't know how you shoot an earthquake, but they did. Maybe they had to wait around for a real one. You know, they're just standing around. It's like, oh, is that it? I think it's time. Is that the ground shaking? No, somebody has gas. Oh shit. But very well done. And to the point where, here's how good it is. This episode 7 was on this week. I read a review of it in Vulture, and they said this is setting up the second half of the story. And I'm like, oh, there's 14 episodes. This is awesome. There's not. There's 10.
Oh.
Second half was like some kind of, they're just using like a screenwriting term. They didn't really mean that it's halfway done. I was like, damn it. You cost.
That's still misleading.
In my mind, in those 30 seconds before I looked it up, there were 7 more episodes of this show. Instead, there's only 3.
That would have been a lot the way they do things anymore.
It would have been. Yeah. 10 actually is, because these are all a real hour. Like, these aren't these burning off a 40-minute episode or a 36-minute episode in one of them. They give you a full hour every time.
Not going to be able to squeeze the reruns on TNT with commercials.
Yeah. And then there was a rumor that they were going to do a second season. They were going to do Shogun 2. And then the showrunner had to say, number one, when you see it, we end it. Like, it comes to a resolution. And also, we started shooting this in 2019, and that got slowed down with the pandemic. They're like, we'd be shooting season 2, or maybe be done with it if we were going to do it. So you're not getting season 2. It's unfortunate. So they'll have to do the, what was the other big, Roots was like the huge miniseries, but then they tried to do like the Winds of War, wasn't that one?
Yeah.
Robert Mitchum, I think. It's going to have to bring back all the old 80s miniseries.
We ain't bringing back Birds. Robert Mitchum. Oh, you mean the show. Okay.
Yeah, you can't bring back Robert Mitchum.
No. Yeah, and then War and Remembrance. I was a big Winds of War fan, and then War and Remembrance came out, and I tuned out. But I liked Winds of War.
Yeah.
I remember there was a scene where Jan Michael Vincent was talking to some Nazis, and like, yeah, I'm circumcised. So I thought that was kind of fun.
Then did he get on his helicopter that could like think for itself? Iron Wolf. Yeah. I remember there was a whole in my like elementary school. There was arguments about what was cooler, Iron Wolf or Blue Thunder, because there were
Airwolf.
I'm thinking of Iron Eagle, and I have that on the mind because of Iron Eagle.
You're mixing up all the good stuff.
Yeah. You heard the story about Ian was talking about the first game. He was the play-by-play announcer for Grant Hill's first college basketball game.
Oh.
And he tells this great story about how they tell Grant that he's going to be working with Ian Eagle. That's going to be the guy. And Grant thinks it's a nickname, that somebody's nickname is Iron Eagle. And he goes to the shoot-around, and there's this guy who he's talking to who seems – and Grant even said afterwards, he's like, I really thought he was like the most educated production assistant I had ever talked to. Like, he knew all the players and he knew all the stuff, and he was talking about all the stuff that's going to happen on the broadcast. And then Ian picks up the story and says, we get to the arena and I sit down in the seat and put the headset on, and Grant looks at me and he's like, wait, you're the play-by-play guy? He kept waiting for like the big name guy, whoever Iron Eagle's nickname was, like Jim Nance or somebody who's going to walk in.
Oh yeah, the old Iron Eagle, Jim Nance. Hi, friends.
Yes. I thought that was funny. That Grant was like completely like, wait a minute, you're the guy. And we have to, well, I'm completely derailed. Might as well keep going. You know, the college basketball, the number one CBS crew hasn't been good for a long time. Like, I never care. I like Jim Nance just fine. I don't think he's a very good basketball announcer.
Yeah.
I hated Billy Packer. Hated him. But that was kind of part of Billy's charm,
I enjoyed
guess,
hating
that
Billy
you didn't
Packer,
like him.
Yeah.
You know, they had good, like, secondary crews. Like, anybody that was out of the Al McGuire,
yes.
that was always a good crew. And when Bill Raftery, whenever they had anybody with Raftery. And for a while, it was Ian Eagle. And they had also done years together with the Nets. So they have a lot of rapport.
Right.
And it makes this team's really good. Grant's kind of in the way, but he's fine. You know,
yeah.
He's even picked up. He calls – Raftery famously calls Ian Bird all the time. And now so does Grant. Calls him Bird all the time, which is, I just think it's really funny. But Ian was on a podcast, and he told one of the great Bill Raftery stories ever. And he said they were doing a game in Syracuse. And he said we were both flying in from different places. And we had to get there for whatever reason, we had to get there 2 days before the game.
Okay.
So we fly, the game's on Saturday. We fly in on Thursday. And he goes, I get a text from Raft that he's landed and he's at a bar and I should go find him at the bar. He says, I go over there and I find him and we sit and we're talking. He says, it's snowing like you wouldn't believe. Just, mm-hmm. He goes, and so we get in a taxi and we go back to the hotel. And the next day we go over for the shoot around and we come back. And then on Saturday we have the game. It's an early game on Saturday. And then we have to go back to the hotel, get our rental cars and both go back to the airport separately. He goes, game ends. We go back to the hotel. He says, I'm getting ready to leave. I'm in my car. I get a panic text from Raftery that he can't find his rental car. You know, the cars are buried in the parking lot. And he's mm-hmm. like, Raft's like, I don't completely remember what I was driving. You know, how many times you do that? You pick up a rental car, and if, you know, you don't get in and out of it all the time, you're like, what did I get? Did I get an Accord? Did I get a Camper? What am I driving? So they're like going through the parking lot and they're like knocking snow off cars. And Raph's like, no, that's not it. That's not it. And Ian is like, he goes, at some point, he's like, we're running out of cars. And I go, Bill, when I met you at the bar on Thursday, did you drive? No, we took a cab back. No, did you drive to the bar? Yes. Well, that's where the car is. So they had to get in Ian's car. He goes, we drive to the bar. There's one car in the parking lot with 40 pounds of snow on it. And Raf goes over and he brushes some of it off. He goes, here it is. He gets in the car and drives to the airport.
Here it is.
He goes, that's Bill's whole life. Just like, just other people's favors bail him out every time. And he's just the most charming. Everybody loves Raft. So Ian's like, I wasn't even mad at him. He had almost made me miss my flight because he couldn't find his rental car. And I was so happy for him when we found it and we both headed to the airport.
I like him more now. Amazing.
Yeah. It's funny. You know, there are plenty of people in sports who people love to tell awful stories about. People love to tell stories about Bill Raftery. They're never bad.
Right.
They're always, you know, what a great guy he is. So. All right, back to this is a baseball podcast. So back to baseball.
Oh, right.
Most teams have played either 5, 6, or 7 games, unless you were the Mets, in which case it played like 2 because it rained every day.
I wonder if they'll do 154. The Mets will bring that back.
I don't think they're gonna have to make up a lot. They are they have a doubleheader today. They lost the first game of the doubleheader to the Tigers. They're 0-5. There are 2 winless teams in the National League East. The Mets are 0-5, and the Marlins are 0-7. On the other hand, in the National League Central, the Pirates and the Brewers were both undefeated until yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to go 16 games in the season to get to 10% of the season. And it would be folly to make any conclusions, but I'm going to anyway. I think the Pirates and the Brewers are the 2 best teams in the National League. Based on their hot start. But I guess I'm going to ask you, has anything happened in the early going that has changed your opinion of a team's prospects, either good or bad?
Well, I see that the Royals are 2-4, and I don't like their chances in the AL Central, but I think they've played well. They played the Twins well, and they played the Orioles well, and now they get the White Sox, so they should be able to get back over 500 pretty soon. I'm not surprised at how well Juan Soto's playing, but it's translated one of the things that has translated them into 6-1 so far. The Red Sox have gotten some really good pitching, and I guess that isn't that surprising, but they're over 500 so far, and
They also got to play the A's three times.
Well, that's true. That's true. And I'm looking at the standings right now to see if there's anything that's going
Well, in our preview, we were two of the people who were like high on the Tigers over at 80 and a half.
Yeah, for sure. They
They only
haven't
got to
played too
win.
many good teams either, but
They only got to win 76 more games.
it's true.
They're already 5-0.
It's true. The Diamondbacks have played well, and they've kind of taken the momentum or whatever from last year, where it was sort of unexpected that they'd play well, and they've continued it, and they added Jordan Montgomery to the rotation. He's not ready to pitch yet, but so I don't know if they'll be particularly competitive with the Dodgers for long, but they should be in the wild card race. So there's that. And the Marlins, who played way over their heads last year, just have way too many injuries. And I think that's a legit 0-7,
Yeah.
honestly.
They're giving off 97 Cub vibes where you start to look at the schedule. I remember going into that 97 season, the Cubs were going to play the 12 of those first 17 games were against the Braves and the Marlins. The Braves were at the height of their Glavine, Maddox, Smoltz era, and the Marlins would win the World Series that year. And even going into it, they had loaded up, and you're like, God, how many, if they could win three or four of those, they should count themselves lucky, and they didn't. They lost them all and started at 114. And you just look at the Marlins, and it's a they have all that young pitching, and so much of it is not
There.
can't throw anything because it's Eury Pérez. They finally diagnosed him with Tommy John disease today, and so he's out for the season. And so that's not great. I feel like the Mets were going to be awful, so I'm not super surprised by the 0-5, but still, it's 5 days. A team with a bad record that I think is actually playing pretty well are the Giants, who are 2-5. They open with 4 games in San Diego and then 3 games in LA before they ever go home. They're also playing. They don't. Blake Snell isn't going to pitch until next week. But their biggest problem last year was they couldn't score any runs, and their offense actually looks like it looks like they actually have a decent offense. Jung-Hoo Lee's been really impressive in his first week in the big leagues. Jorge Soler has not been, but he's gearing up for the he's busy. He's got the eclipse on Monday. After he gets past his eclipse, then he'll be pretty good. Sort of like that. I thought the Cubs offense has looked very good. And it needed to last night. They had to score 9 runs to beat the Rockies. But they did. And the Cubs have a very tough early season schedule, so it was nice to see them sweep the bad team they're going to play, the Rockies, because you got to bank some of those wins.
Dodgers coming up, right?
Yes, yeah, the Dodgers are over the weekend. You open with the defending world champs. They got the Dodgers, then they go a road trip where they go to San Diego, Seattle, and Arizona.
Did you see the Bryce Harper's had a very strange season? He started 0 for his first 4 or 5 games, didn't get a hit, and then hit 3 home runs
3 home runs with a grand slam.
with a grand
One
slam.
of only 60 people in baseball history to do that.
And he had a very funny, if you take the right angle, a very funny blooper where he's running over to the dugout to make a play, and then all of a sudden he flips over the dugout. He's fine, and then the ball lands like way to the left as if he had overrun it by 20 feet. And I believe what happened was it hit a wire or the fence or whatever and took a left turn. And but it was such a traumatic moment that the Phillies are raising the fence over there by the dugout.
Oh boy.
They had lowered the camera well for the sake of photographers taking pictures, and it's like, well, it's too low because Bryce Harper did a woo. And so they're making it higher so he doesn't do that anymore so easily.
I hope they do it on the third base side too, because then if the when the Cubs are in town, Nick Madrigal can actually try to just scale it. like Spider-Man going up the side of a building trying to get
the ball.
Are you
saying he's short?
Yeah, I hardly ever mention it, that he's dainty. The Marquee Sports Network is off to a rough start, but one thing they did do that was pretty funny was last night they showed a picture of the Cubs lined up for the opener, the non-starters lined up alphabetically on opening day when they went out on the line waving to the fans. And in alphabetical order, Luke Little, who isn't, he's 6'8", was standing next to Nick Madrigal. And it very much looked like dad taking the toddler to the theme park. It was very nice. And then Boog and JD referenced the infamous picture of from a few years ago of Aaron Judge standing on second base with Jose Altuve standing next to him. Yeah. So not only is the 6'9" guy standing there, he's also standing on the base. He was basically Victor Wembanyama standing next to Spud Webb. It was very good.
There's another guy I'd like to see hit some home runs in Sacramento, Jose Altuve.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just nice to have baseball back. And I like one of the things I like about the early season schedule is that they're just random day games, which we don't get a lot of. You don't get as many during the season. And so you can just turn the TV on and like, oh, somebody's playing.
I think that, the Twins have not played at night yet. And and will not until next week. Yeah. I don't believe it.
The Cubs do until school lets out, and then again after the kids go back to school, their 7 o'clock games actually start at 6:40.
Yes,
they and do I that. I wish they would just the keep Royals that too. All year long. I like those.
Yeah. Although it's less necessary because of the pitch clock shortening the games, so the games are usually over by 10 o'clock anyway. You know, for the news, but I do like. Yeah, it is. It's not anymore, but through last season, it was still an adjustment to casually watch a baseball game that you weren't necessarily watching, because it's like, oh, you know, I've missed an inning, you know, it went by too fast. So that's not the worst thing in the world, but it's just, it was an adjustment that I needed to, we've talked about that before.
Yeah, it is funny that Rob Manfred was clearly on a crusade to get the pitch clock put in and he was right. Like It dramatically improved the baseball experience, you know, because it cut out all the crap that you didn't miss, you know, a lot of scratching and standing around and doing nothing.
I will say, we'll see about if there's any reason to believe that injuries are more frequent because of it. I don't know if we have enough data or what, but
yeah, I'd like some kind of clearly there has to be some kind of study. I'd like a sports scientist to be able to calculate just what shaving off a few seconds between pitches, if that really has any effect on the recovery. Like, do major league pitchers, is it that much of a difference to their physiology to throw a pitch every 15 seconds as opposed to every 22 seconds? And is it really causing extra strain?
I don't know.
I'm very skeptical. I feel like there's a lot of things that contribute to pitching injuries, and most of them have to do with everybody feeling like they have to throw 1,000 miles an hour and then trying to turn a normal slider into a pitch that breaks an extra 5 inches and, you know, all the torque that people put on their arms. I wonder how much of that is an injury plague in search of a reason.
It could be. I asked a pitcher about this. I asked Pablo Lopez about it. The Twins were in Kansas City the other day, and he's a thoughtful person. And he said he maybe could see it because pitchers who are not in the correct kind of condition might feel themselves rushed, and what they need to do. He offered a fix. He doesn't feel rushed by it, but he's like, they maybe need to work on their anaerobic exercise between starts. That could be a possible link to it. That isn't necessarily it's just the time, but it's how the pitchers are conditioned.
The other thing you could do is you could take the Camilo Duval approach. So the first time he pitched this year, it was in a non-save situation. And not only did he take so long to get to the mound that he only had time to throw two warm-up pitches, but he got two pitch clock violations during his appearance and didn't care.
Right.
Like, they just call it, and Bob Melvin is starting to tear his little hair out in the dugout, and the closer is like, I don't care. So what? It's a ball. I was going to strike this guy out on four pitches. It'll take me five.
Right.
Instead. I will tell you that, I will tell Camilo that is not the greatest strategy in the world. Maybe hurry up a little bit.
Right.
And it even spawned a conversation about one other thing. You know, the teams are doing all kinds of wacky stuff. The Cubs have the fancy new lights, and now the lights actually, they can make little W's when they win. They can shut the lights off in such a way that it makes W's. And this year they added blue and red lights. They can light them up and they can do like thing. The Giants actually, they installed new lights like that, but they also installed a spotlight. And so when Doval comes in for a save opportunity, they're going to shut the lights off and they're going to spotlight him all the way in from the
That's
from
pretty
the
great.
Bullpen. And he's not going to have any warm-up pitches after that. By the time he milks that entrance, it's going to be ball three, and he hasn't even got to the mound yet. So,
what are the old ladies on Alta Vista think of the Wrigley Field light situation? They probably can't stand it.
I thought there was an ambulance on my porch. Turned out it was just the Cubs and their fancy lights. Actually, what they'll do is they'll say, it's a whole different experience to see all the guys peeing in my yard when it's blue, as opposed.
That's my complaint about living in Wrigleyville. So.
Yeah. Well, I probably peed in your yard before.
Probably did.
All right. Well, that was fun. And it's nice to have real games to talk about. And so we'll... We can catch up in a couple of weeks and see what has happened.
And you can finish off your Shogun if there's anything.
Yeah, it'll be almost, there'll be one left when we meet again.
Many of us have herpes.
This is rough, but it's also finished.
It's fitting. It's got to be done with one of the best games of all time. Just unbelievable. Got to congratulate the Dolan family.